Dr. Kifukwe is an independent consultant based in Paris, specializing in leadership and sustainable development in Africa. He served for over 5 years with the government of Tanzania at the Institute of African Leadership for Sustainable Development as the research and policy specialist. He left the institute as the head of department for research and policy. He moved to France to improve his French and enhance his understanding of the Francophonie and of Francophone Africa by enrolling in a master's at Sciences Po. Since 2013, he has been the lead researcher and host of the In Focus and Meet the Leader TV interview programs publicly aired in East Africa. He is currently supporting the OECD's Development Cooperation Directorate's work on triangular cooperation. He holds a PhD in geography from the University of Nottingham and has been honored by numerous young and emerging leaders initiatives in Africa, including UCT's Mandela School's Building Bridges program in 2015. So I welcome our alumni, Dr. Kifukwe, to share his insights from the continent and from his experiences in France as part of the diaspora.
To start off with, what I've observed here, at least in Paris and living in the 18th district or arrondissement, for those of you who are familiar with it, has a significant North African, what they call Maghreb, and Sub-Saharan African community, particularly West African. Here, there have been quite a lot of problems associated with remittances, in part because quite a lot of people have lost permanent jobs, but also have had lowered, let's say, alternative income streams because of the lockdown and stopping activities, particularly restaurants, and therefore the transport sector at large. What this has also shown is the remarkable resilience of African families to find ways to communicate with each other, particularly as for most of us who are privileged here to be able to use the internet and so on, not everyone back home or even here in France has that availability. So what we've seen for Africans based here in France, at least, and it's been a similar story in quite a lot of the diaspora in Europe, at least from what I'm hearing, has been this question of access to technology and the digital divide more broadly, particularly as schools have closed and skills for doing kind of remote working, as well as resources, have come into question. For those of us who have been able to view a lot of the kind of global news, China, of course, has stepped forward and been very aggressive in asserting itself as a global leader, but also as a friend for Africa. Although many of us have also been privy to seeing some of the images of the mistreatment of Africans, particularly in Guangzhou. And so China, like the rest of the world, is also being brought into question for Africans and Africa more broadly. Speaking specifically about youth on the continent, I think it's important to distinguish between various different groups of youth in terms of trying to understand both the impact and then the prospects going forward. I tend to split youth into rural and urban categories because I believe these are two very different populations in Africa. And I'm going to speak very broadly. This is not necessarily true in all instances. When we tend to speak of youth and the opportunities associated with innovation, associated with new opportunities brought about by COVID and everything else going on in Africa, we tend to focus on a very particular educated, middle-class, tech-savvy, connected young Africa, which of course exists and should be celebrated and promoted and nurtured, but doesn't encapsulate all of us in Africa or all Africans broadly. The rural youth in particular have been hit by this crisis, particularly those who are poor. One example has been the closure of schools, which will have not just an educational impact, but also a nutritional one, where a lot of families have relied on schools for a decent meal per day for their children. Now, the longer term nutritional and educational and public health impacts will will have to play out. But this has been significant politically as well. In my country, Tanzania, it's an election year, and the closing of schools, particularly for rural communities who are the majority bloc vote, this has been a very contentious issue, at least in the analysis, though not so much in the public communication. The second major distinction or kind of cutoff when dealing with youth is those who are economically active and therefore able to participate in a lot of activities, and those who are economically dependent, so either those who are vulnerable for whatever reason or those who are too young to work. And here again, there's a very big divide. Young people in Africa have been, you know, involved in mobilizing resources, involved in sensitization and awareness raising campaigns. A lot of them have been able to participate in innovation and funds and be active in trying to combat the virus. A lot of them are providers for their families and have been kind of go-between for public spaces or more mass gathering type spaces and their more vulnerable, say, elderly or even their own children. At the same time, those who are dependent, as I mentioned, have this challenge that has come up with the schools, and we really hope that the longer-term impacts can be at least curbed. Tanzania has a massive problem, for example, already with stunting, both within high-income and low-income families, broadly speaking. And so the crisis may reinforce that, but certainly hasn't introduced this as a problem. The third issue is this argument about comparative advantage of the African young population. I mean, the science will let us know as those investigations unfold. I have a slightly different concern, and some of the work that I've been engaged with here at the OECD has focused on the future of work. And what's one major concern for young people here and in OECD member countries has been the phenomenon of the gig economy, the absence of safety nets, the longer-term decline of collective bargaining and union powers. This has been ongoing since the 80s, it's a longer-term trend. And then now the onslaught of automation and augmentation. And so the future of work more broadly poses challenges for African youth as they're preparing to enter a rapidly changing workforce that has, I think, been compressed, that kind of time frame for transition has been compressed by opportunities from very savvy companies who have downsized, who have accelerated their automation programs in order to stay productive and to stay profitable. And so this will be a challenge for young people as well as an opportunity for those who can kind of latch on and for those who can figure this out, but also for a lot of us who are going to have to ride out this transition. It will be a new arena that we don't know how will play out. From a broader leadership perspective, Africa has always been a fascinating case study for leadership. I personally have always felt that Africa has kind of stayed, I won't say stagnant, but has stayed in what Rousseau would refer to as the phase of the birth of societies. And there's a quote that I've always really liked from The Social Contract, which says, in the birth of societies, it is the chiefs who frame the institutions. And afterwards, it is the institutions which mold the chiefs of the republics. And it seems that in Africa, we're in a constant battle to define what we mean by the birth of our societies. I mean, the rhetoric around decolonization is still very active, for some valid and for, in my argument, some invalid reasons. And I believe that that holds us back. And so from a leadership perspective, we're still trying to define ourselves and our values in terms of what we mean by African societies and therefore African states. And in my view, and to be slightly academic, I think there are two broad tensions that are summarized quite well by Peter Ecke in the seminal work from 1975. You have modern institutions that we're all familiar with, the separation of different parts of the state and powers, balancing of those powers, the different classes that are broadly speaking based on a European industrial and American industrial history. So on the one hand, you have Africa having to adjust to these structures and norms that we are used to seeing, particularly in the West, but in a lot of the world. On the other hand, you have African institutions that exist in and of themselves, and their kind of resistance to these modernizing, or at least being overlooked. And a good example of this is the Gacaca courts in Rwanda. I mean, the most important thing for me in any governance structure, and therefore in any leadership discussion, is the question of justice. And so if your governance and if your leadership is not accessible at the point of concepts, all the structures above it collapse and become meaningless. And this plays out in Africa quite a bit. We see that when certain models don't work from a broader global perspective, African leaders are very quick to either play on local customs, local traditions, and even during election season, these come to the fore, even though we have a very modern understanding of democracy and particularly of elections. A personal anecdote, for example, my father was involved in a local football team, and him, I mean, he's an engineer, and he's an engineer to the point that that's what he puts whenever he fills out these surveys that say, you know, religion, let's just say engineering. And he was involved in a local football team, and he's not a superstitious man, but every Saturday he would disappear for a few hours to go and see a local witch doctor. And one day I, you know, worked up the courage to ask him what's going on. I mean, he doesn't believe in this quote-unquote nonsense. And his response to me was very telling, and I think this is true for the leadership challenge that is particular to Africa, where he said, you know, you and I know it's nonsense, but if I go out there with this football team and we lose, and it turns out that I didn't go and see this witch doctor, who do you think they'll blame? And so the governance or the leadership challenge more broadly in Africa is not just about projecting particular modern values or a particular type of quote-unquote good governance and, you know, carrying everyone along. It's also about relating messages to the expectations, the norms, the comfort zones of the electorate. And so during this COVID crisis, it's been a very interesting case study in communication and the messaging of how the society as a whole can, will, and should tackle the crisis and the kind of spillover effects that come from it. In terms of Tanzania specifically, the messaging has been mixed, to say the least. On the one hand, you've had a very strong narrative from the central government that, you know, business should continue, and the reasons are many. One, limited capacity for testing, the economic fallout, but also that there are other ongoing health concerns that have a higher fatality rate, and they're not preventing Africans or Tanzanians specifically from going to work, and why should this be any different? When we consider the realistic policy options that are available to Tanzania, lockdown just isn't implementable. And when we look to our neighbors in Kenya, although they've done a lot of good work, there's a lot of questionable practices in terms of the enforcement of the lockdowns. So at this point in time, particularly in an election year, the fractures between, say, policing or the police units and military forces in enforcing any lockdown laws or regulations would simply just be too costly politically and, to be honest, probably unfeasible and unsustainable beyond a few days or very specific circumstances. For us, the major fallout and the major problem has been in the tourism industry. 17% of our government's budget is basically about to disappear because of a lack of visitors and then all of the kind of linked activities that go with that, restaurants, tour operators, and, you know, cargo handling, everything that is tied to that. And so Tanzania is very aggressively trying to re-encourage normality, almost by force of will. And very famously this Sunday we had an end of Corona party that was celebrated, and the message has been, you know, we need to get back to work, move on. And since we had began this talk with a quote from Churchill, I'd like to end at least this part of my contribution with another quote from Churchill, which I think encapsulates at least Tanzania's approach, and I think quite a lot of the world's approach, for better or for worse, is the following. If you're going through hell, keep going. So with that, I'll end my contributions for now, and I look forward to discussing with all of you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gomarka. Many interesting viewpoints from the youth to the diaspora to modernity, post-modernity, and leadership responses, and especially the case of Tanzania.
So in terms of civil society compensating for flawed or limited government systems, I don't think that's a particularly helpful way of analyzing or even approaching any work going forward. Ultimately, the two will have to work together because government systems have an authority, have a legitimacy, and have a duty to address these problems. That's not to say the problems don't exist, but I think creating that tension, or at least exacerbating that tension between civil society and the state through service delivery, particularly with political figures, can sometimes undermine efforts on both sides. For a country like Tanzania, where civil society emerges much more because of an influx of NGOs in the 90s. I mean, we went from having less than, I think, 300 in 1991 to having over 90,000 by the end of the 90s in terms of registered NGOs. Means that the dynamic, at least from Tanzania, is very different. And we cannot assume on face value that NGOs or civil society organizations necessarily promote progressive agendas. So there has to be that back and forth, that constant dialogue, that constant power struggle between civil society and the state, or at least whoever is in charge. And so for me, and this is something I learned through UCT, this idea of working with the grain is key. Of course, that's a longer term strategy. That's not easy always to implement, particularly when there are short term needs. But I think trying to find ways of bypassing governmental collaboration is wrong. Rather, if the government is not willing to collaborate, I would advise, go ahead, do what you can, keep the government informed, because from all experiences I'm aware of, government hates to be surprised, particularly from civil society, and then find a way to build the trust so that in future, these kinds of relationships and institutions can be relied upon. Specifically, just as a last point, for international NGOs and more kind of cross-country civil society organizations, they cannot operate in any jurisdiction by law without government approval. And so by definition, the idea of bypassing is just not viable and probably not advisable. We've seen already a lot of accusations that these are imperial forces, to use that language, or have external vested interests. And that may be true in some cases, but to avoid that, if it's going to be really a mission focus, the two need to learn to collaborate on each other's terms. And for civil society, that challenge is much more daunting because they don't have the same political legitimacy behind them, rightly or wrongly. Thank you.
Here we have a question around certain species and how do we, in the midst of looking at the impact of the virus on humanity, how do we also be mindful about the impact on our environment COVID, during the COVID and post-COVID?
I mean, there's valid evidence to suggest that there are going to be more pandemics going forward and that there's a strong link with ongoing environmental crises. But I would caution against making too direct a link. I mean, epidemics are not historically new to us as a species or as a bunch of civilizations. I think what really this has pointed out is a structural problem. We have a history of epidemics across the world. And honestly, I think we as a collective, as a humanity, just got lazy. Epidemics are really about vigilance. We had Spanish flu, we've had Black Death, and so on. And particularly in Europe, this has come at a really interesting time as we've seen the rolling back of the welfare state. And I think there's been a clash of kind of two schools of thought. On the one hand, you have the argument that is more behavioral. We need to change the way we act, the way we consume, the way we go about our business. And that has environmental, economic, and all kinds of sustainability questions. On the other hand, you have a more technical approach that assumes, and I think has an overconfidence in my personal opinion, that these can be technically solved. And so we've kind of dropped the ball on vigilance, on basic sanitary practices that we've been preaching now during this pandemic, because we've had an overconfidence in technical solutions. And I think you do need a mix of both going forward. As a result, yes, there are strong links to the environment. Yes, we need to do much better at how we manage and interact and respect the environment. But that is not going to be the sole source of future pandemics. And really the key thing here is vigilance and investing in the infrastructure and having the safety nets around in case something does break out, that we can respond quickly.
on the issue of the crisis subverting gender equity initiatives?
I think COVID-19 has brought to focus quite a lot of these issues that, although have been part of the development discussion for a long time in Africa, have raised other areas, or at least kind of refocused other areas. Globally speaking, there's been a concern about domestic violence for both men and women, and how that's combated because of the lockdown procedures. But the second has been on access to things like mental health services, both in terms of what is available and the cultures around people accessing them. So, you know, typically, or at least the data is playing out that men do not access mental health services as much, and we've had a spate of suicides, a spike in domestic violence associated with particular forms of masculinity and definitions thereof. I don't think COVID will subvert initiatives. I think that can be built into any program without too much of a fuss or any additional resources. Maybe I say this as a self-defined feminist, but for me, you know, if the principle is equality, that's not really something that that costs. It's a behavioral shift, and that's not to take away from the technical work, but I don't see COVID as subverting that particular agenda. And given how gender roles are structured in a lot of Africa, going forward, any solution that is going to be proposed will inherently, whether by design or not, will impact on our current gender relations, and it's in our interest to really do this consciously to address them, to create a more balanced and equal society. So I don't think, personally, in the big picture, COVID-19 will subvert.